Paul can launch into the quite detailed instructions of chapter 4, verse 17, to chapter 5, verse 20, which find several parallels in Colossians chapter 3, but in most cases with fuller development in Ephesians. Thus again, we find Paul emphasizing the renewal of the mind. Put away, says, the old human, which is corrupt in accordance with its deceitful desires, deceitful presumably because they promise a full and genuine human existence, but give exactly the opposite, and be renewed in the spirit of your minds, chapter 4, verse 23, which we might equally well translate, be renewed in your minds by the Spirit, and put on the new human, who is created in accordance with God in righteousness and in the holiness which belongs to the truth, chapter 4, verse 24. This is close to Colossians, chapter 3, verse 10, and also to Romans, chapter 12, verse 2, and with the same import. The goal is the renewed humanity which at last truly reflects God's image, and the pathway to that goal is the renewal and full activity of the mind. There then follows a catalogue of the new habits that must be acquired, and of the old habits and practices that must now be shunned. Chapter 4, verses 25 to chapter 5, verse 2, chapter 5, verse 3 through 20. As always, the eschatological note is never far away. These are not, as the heading in one translation puts it, rules for the new life, but habits of heart and mind, ways of learning how to think Christianly about the ultimate future and about the pathway toward it, the pathway which is, as it were, a daily resurrection, chapter 5, verse 14. Again, for the avoidance of misunderstanding, I am not saying that rules are irrelevant or unnecessary within the life of virtue, merely that they are neither the starting point nor the destination. 7. All this, from Romans, Philippians, Colossians, and Ephesians, ought to leave us in no doubt that Paul is thinking substantially in terms of an eschatologically driven virtue ethic which outdoes anything the pagan world can offer. He has glimpsed a fresh vision of the ultimate future, which has given him in turn a fresh vision of the habits of life by which humans can already live in the present as people shaped by that future. The goal is God's new creation, and the full human maturity and dignity which will ultimately be celebrated in the resurrection. The pathway to that goal is the complete set of learned habits of life, of heart and body and especially mind. Straight, clear, sharp thinking not only grasps the goal and the pathway, but is itself part of that maturity of which Paul speaks. To put it the other way around, if the mind is downgraded, one will be less than fully and truly human, partly because one will not grasp the goal or the path, and thus will wander off course, but even more so because one part of the fully human makeup will not be in operation, and will not therefore be integrated with everything else. Thus, as we have seen earlier, thinking about what one ought to be doing is one of the key elements in virtue ethics, as opposed to schemes of ethics based either upon mere rules obeyed unthinkingly, or upon spontaneity or authenticity. In the former case, you don't need to think anymore once you've got the rules. But, like certain rugby players who have learned dozens of formal moves, but have never really acquired a second nature instinct for the game, you will be lost when a new situation arises for which the rules, the formal moves within the rugby game, provide no clear answer. In the latter case, spontaneity or authenticity, you shouldn't think too hard. In fact, you shouldn't really think at all, because what matters is what comes naturally. Paul does, of course, want the young Christians to develop to the point where, as mature followers of Jesus Christ, they will gradually find that the Christian habits of heart and life come naturally. But to get to that point, they must learn to think, must be transformed by the renewal of their minds, and must then allow that transformation to inform and redirect their habits of life. Here, in fact, is one of the major differences between virtue ethics and other schemes of thought. The thinking is front-loaded. A person relying on a duty or rule-based ethic, faced with a challenge or dilemma, needs to think on the spot. Is there a rule? Is there a duty? Someone using a utilitarian-based ethic needs to do quite a bit of thinking. How will doing this, or not doing it, affect the sum total of human happiness? A person following a spontaneity ethic, of course, won't want to think at all. For someone developing a virtue ethic, on the other hand, the hard thinking has already been done some time before a particular crisis or challenge presents itself. The character has been formed by conscious choice and habit. Whether or not there is time for thought, the emergency will be met and dealt with. Paul is very much aware that the entire mode of Christian living, More than the sum of its individual ethical parts is a new thing to be thought through, studied, reflected upon, and practiced, and that without this effort, churches will simply slide back into the ways of the old world. And fully aware of the risks he is taking by going this route, he draws attention to himself and his close associates as examples of what this new way of life will look like. His converts will never have seen anyone living this way before, and they must hold before their minds and memories the examples they have. So let me appeal to you. Copy me. That's why I have sent Timothy to you. He is my child in the Lord, and I love him and trust him. He will remind you how I conduct myself in the Messiah Jesus, just as I teach everywhere, in each assembly. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 17. Be blameless before Jews and Greeks and the Church of God, just as I try to please everybody and everything, not pursuing my own advantage, but that of the great majority, so that they may be saved. Copy me, just as I'm copying the Messiah. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 32 through chapter 11, verse 1. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, so that I may be encouraged in my turn by getting news about you. I have nobody else of his quality. He would genuinely care about how things are with you. All the rest you see are looking after their own interests, not those of Jesus the Messiah. But you know how he has proved himself. Like a child with a father, he has slaved with me for the sake of the gospel. Philippians chapter 2, verses 19 through 22. Join together in imitating me, my dear family, and pay careful attention to people who behave according to the pattern you have in us. Philippians chapter 3, verse 17. This is what you should do. What you learned, received, heard, and saw in and through me, and the God of peace will be with you. Philippians chapter 4, verse 9. You know what sort of people we turned out to be for your sake when we were amongst you, and you learned how to copy us and the Lord. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 5b through 6. You yourselves know, after all, how you should copy us. We didn't step out of line, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. We worked night and day, with labor and struggle, so as not to place a burden on any of you. It wasn't that we didn't have the right. It was so that we could give you an example, for you to copy us. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 7 through 9. Throughout these passages, Paul is indicating that there is a new way of living to which Jesus' followers are now committed, and that one of the ways to sustain the commitment to live that way is to hold before the mind such examples as there may be. To this we shall return. In and through all of this, Paul is explicitly developing an ethic of character. At the key transition between Romans chapter 4 and Romans chapter 5, in a passage at which we have already glanced in another connection, he sketches out a theory of how character is formed, pointing forward to, and deriving its meaning from, the ultimate hope, hope for the glory of God. The result is this. Since we have been declared in the right on the basis of faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus the Messiah. Through him we have been allowed to approach, by faith, into this grace in which we stand, and we celebrate the hope of the glory of God. That's not all. We also celebrate in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces patience. Patience produces a well-formed character, dokime, and a character like that produces hope. Hope in its turn does not make us ashamed, because the love of God has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. Romans chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. There are two key things here for our present purposes, hope and character construction. The hope is, as Paul states clearly, the glory of God. We have spoken of this already in terms of two interlocking themes, the sovereign stewardship over creation entrusted by God to humankind, and the return of the divine glory to dwell amidst God's people after the long years of the exile. This latter theme seems to be in the back of Paul's mind in several of his writings, but not least here in Romans chapter 5, and in the continuation of the same theme in chapter 8, where the Spirit dwells within believers, evoking the theme of God dwelling in the temple in the Old Testament, chapter 8, verses 4 through 11. Frustratingly, the word glory is so often used in Christian circles as a vague word for going to heaven that these important overtones to the concept of the glory of God, overtones that would have been audible to Paul and his first hearers, are often ignored altogether. What Paul is saying, and it is of central importance for this whole book, is that the hope to which we press, The telos, or goal of all our pilgrimage, is the glory of God. When this is explained, it means on the one hand the royal priesthood we studied earlier, the vocation of genuine humanness, and on the other hand, the place where the living God himself comes to dwell in fulfillment of his ancient promise. Both parts of this were realized by Jesus himself, as we saw. Paul's point, throughout Romans chapters 5 through 8, but particularly in chapter 8, is that both are also realized through the presence and power of the Holy Spirit in and through God's people. Some people say that the early Christians had no Trinitarian theology, but that position can be sustained only by carefully putting the telescope to the blind eye. But if God's glory is the goal, what is the route toward it? What are the character-forming habits that put together the genuine humans, the God-bearing, Spirit-filled humans, who will one day rule God's new creation and sum up its praises? In answer, we are brought up short with a theme which, as Paul well knew, not least when writing 2 Corinthians, would have been anathema to the whole classical tradition, Aristotle included, and also to anyone, including any Christian, who had not fully thought through the way in which the gospel of Jesus Christ transformed the ideal of human living. The theme is stark and challenging. In order to develop Christian character, the first step is suffering. Two impulses pushed Paul into this shocking and unwelcome conclusion. There was, first, the suffering of the Messiah himself. Second, there was the suffering which he, Paul, had formerly inflicted upon the church, and had then undergone himself at the hands of both zealous Jews and of pagan authorities and mobs. Acts gives a small window on all of this. From 2 Corinthians chapter 11, we may deduce that there was much more besides. But what provided Paul with a theological framework for coming to terms with all this, and indeed making it central in his understanding? The tradition of ancient Israel within which Paul stood had come, slowly but surely, to understand suffering as somehow falling within the saving purposes of God. This finds expression particularly in books such as Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Daniel, and of course in the Psalms. We know in addition that Paul made Jesus' crucifixion thematic for his own life and teaching, as we see in many places, perhaps particularly 2 Corinthians. We do not know, though I think it likely, whether he knew any of the specific traditions stemming from Jesus, such as the beatitude on those who were persecuted and the challenge to take up the cross. He certainly reflected on the suffering in terms of Christians being out of step with the world around them and at odds with the powers that exercise authority within that world. People whose lives cut across the expectations of the world and its rulers can expect to suffer suspicion, hostility, and various forms of attack. People who find themselves in that sort of situation as a result of following a crucified Messiah, and who see his own suffering within the context of the Jewish expectation of God's saving purposes, will have a grid of understanding within which to interpret what is happening to them, and to give it theological and moral meaning. What we find here in Romans chapter 5 is that Paul incorporates suffering not only into a general statement about suffering with Christ in order to be glorified with him, see also chapter 8 verse 17, compare 2 Corinthians chapter 4 verse 10 and similar passages such as Philippians chapter 3 verses 10 and 11, but into a remarkable, almost unique statement about character formation. Suffering produces endurance or patience. Endurance produces character. Not just any sort of character, but one that has been tried and tested and has proved its worth. And character gives birth to hope, a hope which does not disappoint. This sequence, coming at a crucial turning point in the letter, shows beyond any doubt that Paul did indeed envisage the whole question of Christian living on the model of the classic virtue tradition, but that he had radically rethought this tradition around Jesus and the Spirit, changing both its content and its shape, but retaining the key elements. The sense of an ultimate telos, and the insistence on working toward that goal by character-building, habit-forming steps. I said that Romans chapter 5, verses 1 through 5 was almost unique, but there are two other New Testament passages which offer similar sequences of thought, looking for all the world like carefully thought-out agendas for the development of virtue. Reckon it all joy, my dear family, when you fall into the middle of different kinds of testing. You know that the trying and testing dakimion of your faith produces patience, and let patience produce its perfect work, ergon teleon, so that you may be complete teleoi, and fully kitted out, lacking in nothing. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. That is why you must bring every bit of energy you have to bear on the task of supplementing your faith with virtue, arete, one of only three uses of the word in the New Testament, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with patience, and patience with godliness, and godliness with family affection, and family affection with love, agape. If you have these things in plenty, you see, they will ensure that you are not wasting your time or bearing no fruit in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. 2 Peter chapter 1 verses 5 through 8. Here we are clearly in the same world of thought. All these characteristics lead to one another, of course. The point is not to spend some years acquiring the first and then move on to the second and so on. They work together. And the point is their forward look. The aim of it all is to be fruitful in working for Jesus. 2 Peter. To be complete. Teleoi, ready for whatever contingency may arise, since your character has been formed to be prepared for anything and everything. James. We could no doubt spend much longer on these passages, but the general point is clear. All this leads to a number of major and interlocking questions, which will take us into the next chapter. If this was Paul's theory about Christian living, how did the practice work out? More particularly, where do things such as the fruit of the Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit fit in? Why does Paul highlight the character traits he does? And what is he able to take for granted when he refers simply to good and evil in the apparent assumption that his readers will know what he's talking about? When he spells out other instructions, is he simply supplementing his virtue ethic with a few rules to carry on with? And if so, is there a reason for this? In particular, and growing out of all these, why does he again and again highlight faith, hope, and love? What role do those traits play within his overall thinking about Christian character? Are they virtues in any classical sense? And if so, how does putting them in this privileged position alter the very character of virtue itself? And over and around it all, how does Paul's sense of the church as a single body, a united community, form part of the necessary context for the practice of Christian virtue? Chapter 6. Three virtues, 9 varieties of fruit, and 1 body. 1. When the perfect comes, then the partial will be abolished. Some of Paul's hearers might have detected echoes of Aristotle, for whom perfection to teleon was the goal. Paul is undoubtedly aware of the tradition of pagan moral thought, but he has translated it into a different register. The line comes, of course, from the heart of Paul's greatest chapter on the greatest virtue, which tells us an enormous amount not only about how he saw that virtue in particular, but about how he understood virtue in general. We know in part, he says, and we prophesy in part, contrasting the temporary gifts with the permanent virtue of love. But when the perfect comes, then the partial will be abolished. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 verses 9 and 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is one of the best known passages in all of Paul, partly I suspect because many couples still choose to have it read in public at their wedding, though if they reflected on it line by line, they might find it quite a daunting challenge. Love is great-hearted, love is kind, knows no jealousy, makes no fuss, not puffed up, no shameless ways, doesn't force its rightful claim, doesn't rage or bear a grudge, doesn't cheer at others' harm, rejoices rather in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things. Love hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Fair enough to hold before yourselves that astonishing portrait, but don't imagine that you can just step into it on a cheerful sunny morning and stay there effortlessly forever. The last lines tell their own story. Bearing, believing, hoping, enduring, never failing. All these speak of moments, hours, days, and perhaps years when there will be things to bear, things to believe against apparent evidence, things to hope for which are not seen at present, things to endure, things which threaten to make love fail. The phrase tough love now sounds hackneyed, a relic of social debates from the day before yesterday. But the love of which Paul speaks is tough. In fact, it's the toughest thing there is. The love of which Paul speaks is clearly a virtue. It is not a rule of the sort that is so out of fashion nowadays, imposed in an arbitrary fashion and to be obeyed out of a sense of duty. We shall discuss the more serious question of proper rules and their relation to virtue later on. It is not a principle, a generalized rule which a person either obeys or disobeys. It is not a prudential maxim based on calculated effects, though it has to be said that if even a few more people lived in the way Paul describes, a lot more people would be a lot more happy. Nor especially is it the result of people doing what comes naturally. At every single point in Paul's catalogue of what love does and what love doesn't do, we want to say, yes, I see what you mean. However, left to my own inclinations, I would be small-minded, unkind, jealous, fussy, puffed up, shameless, and so on. In particular, left to myself, there are some things I wouldn't bear, many things I wouldn't believe, several things I wouldn't be able to hope for, and a whole multitude that I wouldn't endure. Left to myself, doing what comes naturally, I would fail. But the point of love is that it doesn't. That is why love is a virtue. It is a language to be learned, a musical instrument to be practiced, a mountain to be climbed via some steep and tricky cliff paths, but with the most amazing view from the top. It is one of the things that will last, one of the traits of character which provides a genuine anticipation of that complete humanness we are promised at the end. And it is one of the things, therefore, which can be anticipated in the present on the basis of the future goal, the telos, which is already given in Jesus Christ. It is part of the future which can be drawn down into the present. Here, as most people are vaguely aware but few really reflect on, we have a problem of language. A problem about this particular blessed word, love. The English word love is trying to do so many different jobs at the same time that someone really ought to sit down with it and teach it how to delegate. It isn't simply a matter, as some people used to think, of getting back to the true meaning of the Greek word agape. That word, actually, had almost as much of a checkered career in the centuries before and after Paul as our word love, and for that matter charity, has had in the last 300 years. A glance at the Greek lexicon indicates that agape and its cognates were used across several spectrums of meaning, covering affection, erotic passion, contentment with something or someone, prizing something highly, and so on. Sometimes agape was distinguished from philia, which we often translate as friendship, and sometimes the two appear to have been interchangeable. The specific meaning of agape, which we find in the New Testament, isn't the result of the early Christians discovering a word which already said exactly what they wanted to say and latching onto it. Rather, they seem to have settled quickly on this word as the best available one, and they then gave it the fresh privilege of carrying a new depth of meaning in which some aspects of its previous career were highlighted and others were set aside. The early Christians, in fact, did with the word agape pretty much what they did with the ancient notion of virtue. They picked it up, soaked it in the message and achievement of Jesus, and gave it a new life, a new sort of life. It isn't surprising that in the ancient world, just as today, words for love would carry a wide variety of meaning and would slide to and fro between those variations. After all, the question of how we humans relate to one another and of how we mark the fact that we delight in and approve of, or are appalled by and disapprove of, certain styles of that relating, and how these perceptions and moral beliefs change across time and culture is enormously complex. Novels, poems, plays, and movies, not to mention ordinary experience in families and among friends, scatter so much information on the subject that it's a bit like looking up at the sky on a clear and cloudless night and seeing not only millions of stars and planets, but also meteors, shooting stars and satellites. There are not just four things called love, as in the title of C.S. Lewis's important book on the subject. As Lewis himself would readily have agreed, there are 4,004, or perhaps 4,000,004. We need a huge range of words, as at least in urban mythology the Inuit peoples have for different kinds of snow, to map the complex and shifting nature of what, in English, we still just call love. Fortunately, in terms of our present argument, we don't need to get into that mapwork. We just need to note that Paul, like the other early Christians, settled on the word agape to do a job which nobody had realized needed doing until then. Nobody until then had really glimpsed, in quite the way those early Christians did, the challenge to embody a virtue so profound, so life-changing, so community-defining, so revolutionary, both in its nature and its effects, and in the moral character needed to aspire to it, that people in Paul's own day thought he was mad. Indeed, people ever since, even within the church, have balked at the challenge and settled for second best, or 22nd best. Agape sets the bar as high as it can go. The first thing to do before we can discuss it is to acknowledge that we have all failed quite drastically to clear that height. Then with that on the table, we can set ourselves the task of thinking through, in the first place, what Paul is saying about the perfect and the partial. This is the key to understanding how he supposes virtue works and what it consists of. 2. When the perfect comes, the partial will be abolished. The word Paul uses for the perfect is our old friend teleos, the adjective, treated here as a noun, the perfect thing, to teleon. This word carries two adjacent meanings which, as with love itself, are difficult to bring out in English. On the one hand, it indicates a sense of something having reached its goal at last, of a cup slowly filled but at last brimful, or a long and winding pilgrimage which has finally arrived at its goal. On the other hand, it gives the slightly different sense of maturity or completeness, contrasting the former in particular with youthfulness or immaturity. That's the sense which Paul then develops in the next verse. Having said, "When the perfect comes, the partial will be abolished," he goes on at once, "When I was a child, I spoke, thought, and reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I got rid of," literally abolished, as in the previous verse, "childish ways." Paul thus stresses the permanence of agape as the main reason for urging the muddled Christians of Corinth to work at it. This is the language of virtue, albeit obviously in a Christian accent. Aristotle, and the tradition stemming from him, would have seen human maturity simply in terms of human flourishing, the complete human character in the present life, rather than looking into a coming age in which the partial vision of the present time would give way to face-to-face knowing. Verse 12. For Paul, it is the permanence which counts. The chapter is carefully and beautifully structured in three movements. In the opening paragraph, chapter 13, verses 1 through 3, Paul stresses that all other Christian experience without agape is worthless. Tongues, prophecy, mystery, knowledge, mountain-moving faith, self-sacrificial living, unless there is agape, you might as well not bother. Then comes the lyrical middle paragraph, quoted at the start of this chapter. Then the final section, balancing the first and gently but firmly pushing home the point. It is the permanence of faith, hope, and love, but especially love, which makes it worthwhile to work at it. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 advances its point almost as much by its aesthetic appeal as by its logic, though that too is profound. The final section of the chapter is all about things that won't last and things that will. Love never fails, but prophecies will be abolished. Tongues will stop, and knowledge too be done away. We know you see in part. We prophesy in part. But with perfection, the partial is abolished. As a child I spoke and thought and reasoned like a child. When I grew up, I threw off childish ways. For at the moment all that we can see is puzzling reflections in a mirror, then face to face. I know in part for now, but then I'll know completely through and through, even as I'm completely known. So now, faith, hope, and love remain. These three, and of them all, love is the greatest. This notion of some things that won't last, and others that will, is based on the assumption, which underlies the argument of Paul's whole letter, and will finally be unveiled in chapter 15, that the present life is the first phase in a much longer existence, and that between the present and the ultimate future, there will be strong continuity as well as some radical discontinuity. The promise and hope of resurrection, in other words, is the thing that has both reshaped how virtue works and also given it fresh moral content. If for this life only we have hoped in the Messiah, we are of all people most pitiable. Chapter 15, verse 19. And you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Chapter 15, verse 58b. All this brings into clear focus what was said in scattered fashion earlier in the letter. Don't judge anything until the time when the Lord comes, who will bring to light things now hidden in darkness and disclose the intentions of the hearts. Chapter 4, verse 5. God raised the Lord and will raise us by his power. Therefore glorify God in your body. Chapter 6, verses 14 and 20. The continuity between the present life and the future one undergirds much of Paul's teaching about how to behave in the present. Yes, there are indeed some elements of present Christian life which will no longer be needed. Ironically, they include some of the things which the Corinthians, like some people today, are tempted to regard as very spiritual and hence superior to the humdrum disciplines of ordinary Christian living. Impermanent things include those strange phenomena which can carry the life of heaven into parts of the earth in the present time, tongues, prophecy, and special gifts of knowledge. All three will be made redundant when the reality comes, as candles are made redundant by the sunrise. A great transition, a great transformation is on the way, which for us will be like the transformation from childhood to mature adult life, the transition from peering into a smoky mirror to seeing someone face to face. Chapter 13, verse 12. The shift from glimpsing parts of a jigsaw puzzle but having no idea how they fit together to seeing the whole thing, complete, at a single glance. Chapter 13, verse 12b. Or to match more exactly what Paul says, from glimpsing parts of the puzzle to realizing that the puzzle is not only complete, but is looking back at us. Now I know in part, then I shall know, even as also I am known. Paul is writing here with a careful subtlety. The contrast of immature childhood and mature adulthood is a metaphor for the coming transition from the present life to the resurrection life, yet it seems more than just a metaphor. There is also a sense similar to that in Galatians chapter 4 verses 1 through 7, though making a slightly different point, that we are indeed God's immature children now and will one day be grown up. The contrast between looking in a cloudy mirror and seeing face to face is a metaphor for the coming transition. Yet for Paul, there is a sense that we do indeed at the moment peer into the midst of the present world and dimly discern God and his ways, and that one day we will see clearly. And when he comes to knowing in part, and knowing fully, as we are fully known, picking up a theme from earlier in the letter at chapter 8 verses 1 through 3, we are passing beyond figures of speech into as direct a statement as is possible in such matters. It is as though Paul, though at one level inevitably employing picture language, is constantly working back as best he can toward the reality itself. With that we may grasp as well the explanation for why agape is one of the three things that will last from the present world into the future, and is indeed the principal one of those three things. To know as we are known is to pass beyond virtue into worship, or perhaps we should say it is the point where virtue becomes worship, or where worship becomes the summit of the heart habits we call virtue. It is the point at which we are formed by God's Spirit into a royal priesthood. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 comes, after all, in between the two chapters in which Paul discusses the church's worshiping life. This is the center of it all. Thus the agape we are called to practice in the present, to learn like a difficult but powerful language, and to practice like a beautiful but complex musical instrument, will last into the future world, indeed will be gloriously fulfilled in the future world, because it is the very essence of the God we know in Jesus Christ. The God whom Paul had come to recognize in the face of the crucified and risen Jesus is the God of utter self-giving love, and if we humans are called to reflect this God, to be renewed in knowledge according to his image, then it is not surprising that love of this sort is the key element in that future life and in its anticipation here and now. It will abide. Chapter 13, verse 13. It will remain. It is the supreme example of the principle Paul articulates two chapters later, chapter 15, verse 58. What we do in the present, in the Lord, is not wasted. Love is the language they speak in God's world, and we are summoned to learn it against the day when God's world and ours will be brought together forever. It is the music they make in God's courts, and we are invited to learn it and practice it in advance. Love is not a duty, even our highest duty. It is our destiny. Welcome then to Paul's greatest exposition of the greatest virtue. Here is the goal, the telos, the state where we are to share in tou teleon, the perfect, the complete, the mature. One day the whole cosmos will attain perfection, completeness, maturity. Within that renewed cosmos, human beings will attain the perfection proper to them, the maturity which will enable them at last to be the royal priesthood, mediating God's wise stewardship to the world and the world's glad worship back to its maker. And if that is the goal, here are the virtues, the strengths, the habits of heart, mind, and life, which will form you into the person you need to be for that day, and will anticipate, even within the present partial and incomplete world, something of the life of the new and complete one. Virtue for Paul is part of inaugurated eschatology, part of the life of the future breaking into the present. That is why it is both hard and glorious work. 3. Before we look any further at the three great virtues, however, not least at the quite natural question, "That's all very well, Paul, but how can we even begin to reach towards such a high ideal?" we must look at the second great Pauline theme which stands beside it. In Galatians chapter 5, Paul speaks of the fruit of the Spirit. And here, as in the three great virtues, the top of the list is agape. Clearly these belong together. But how? When Paul lists nine varieties of the fruit of the Spirit, Galatians chapter 5 verses 22 and 23, he does so having just announced a crucial introductory point. If you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Verse 18. In today's climate of thought, with a certain set of questions directing our ethical search, that great statement is almost bound to be misheard and seriously misunderstood. To show you what I mean about mishearing something because you're thinking of a different set of questions, imagine sitting in a coffee shop and overhearing a snatch of conversation from the next table. You have no idea who the people are or what they're talking about. All you hear is a single sentence. "We shall end it at C." But what does it mean? Perhaps the people are part of an educational board trying to produce a new structure for recording and tabulating exam results. Do we want a structure with five passing grades, A, B, C, D, and E, with F meaning fail? Or is that too drastic? Do we really need five grades? "No," declares the chairman. "The list will be long enough with just three categories. We shall end it at C. That's as far as we need to go." Or supposing they're from a publisher's office, trying to decide where to divide a multi-volume encyclopedia. Clearly the book is going to spread way beyond a single volume, or even two or three. But all the early material is now in hand, and the question is, at what point in the alphabet are we going to call a halt to volume one? Answer: we shall end it at C. The next volume will perhaps run from D to F. Or supposing they're discussing a possible Mediterranean cruise. The ship will be stopping at various ports, but one of the participants is hoping to meet up with a friend who will be on shore near one of the scheduled port calls. She is asking the organizers whether it will be possible for her friend to come to the party on board ship that night and then disembark again before the ship sails. "Sorry, no," comes the reply. "The ship will need to catch the evening tide. As for the party, well, we shall end it at sea, the ship having already sailed." We might imagine other examples too. Think, for instance, of the composer Jean Sibelius, planning to end his matchless Seventh Symphony at the point where the music finally resolves into a great chord of C major, but the point is no doubt clear already. A single sentence can carry quite different meanings, depending on the implicit question or set of questions the hearer has in mind to which the sentence is perceived as the answer. So with Paul. "If you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law." Someone today catching just that snatch of conversation is very likely to hear it in terms of the strong implicit debate between those who think you should order your life by rules and those who think that what matters is doing what comes naturally, living spontaneously or authentically. And it isn't just our cultural climate that makes us assume that's the sort of conversation we're overhearing. For 400 years, the religious and theological climate has conditioned us to hear a religious version of the same point. Ever since the Reformation, at least, a large number of Christians have assumed that the foundation of Paul's thinking goes like this. He spent the first part of his life trying to keep the rules of his religion, and then discovered not only that he couldn't, but that rules weren't the point. God didn't want rule-keeping. He wanted spontaneity. God had forgiven him all his rule-breaking in and through Jesus Christ, and was now giving him his Spirit, who would produce the fruit without all that horrible moral striving. But is that what the conversation at the next table was really all about? In this way of interpreting, the listener assumes that when Paul says law or the law, he isn't meaning the Jewish law, the law of Moses, or at least not particularly. If there is a reference to it, it's just because that was the particular type of law Paul knew. From this point of view, we are all under the law in some sense or other, since all human beings are aware of some kind of moral code hanging over them, telling them what to do and making them feel guilty when they don't. And Paul's message within this way of thinking is, you're free from all that. The Spirit will guide you from within, and you don't need to bother about all those rules that come at you from somewhere else, from tradition or philosophy or the Old Testament. Stop worrying about all that moralism. Lighten up and be spontaneous. You don't have to try. Moral effort is a sign that you're still on the wrong track. All you have to do is to go with the flow of the Spirit. All of which is no more relevant to what Paul is actually talking about than the encyclopedia meaning is when someone overhears the travel agent saying, "We shall end it at sea." Paul is not discussing the question of rules versus spontaneity. He is talking about the great change that has come over the people of God with the death and resurrection of the Messiah and the gift of the Spirit. The law, that is, the Mosaic law, was God's gift for the period of time that came to an end with the Messiah. Paul argued that point in Galatians chapter 3, verses 15 through 29. This, however, has come as news to some in the Galatian church, who had been taught that the Mosaic law, at least those stipulations such as circumcision and the food laws, which marked out Jews from their pagan neighbors, were to be required of all converts from paganism to make sure they were genuinely members of God's people, were truly Abraham's children. Paul disagrees. Abraham's children consist of all those who believe in Jesus the Messiah and are baptized into him, no matter what their ethnic origin and no matter what their relation to the Jewish law. Paul then turns the tables on his opponents with considerable irony, and this is the context in which he expounds the various fruit of the Spirit with agape at the head. All this concentration on the Mosaic law, the Torah, has resulted in huge fights within the Galatian church. Isn't that a sign that something has gone wrong? After all, the best available summary of the whole law is love your neighbor as yourself, Galatians chapter 5 verse 14. As in Romans chapter 13 verses 8 through 10, which we shall consider later on, Paul here in Galatians is quoting from Leviticus chapter 19 verse 18. Yes, he says, the whole law is summed up in this one saying, love your neighbor as yourself. So how can you be law-abiding if you are breaking the most fundamental principle of the law itself? On the contrary, you are going in the opposite direction and asking for mutual destruction, chapter 5 verse 15. What is the alternative? Summarizing in a dense couple of sentences what he will later spell out in much more detail in Romans, Paul indicates that there is a way to fulfill what the law was really trying to accomplish, but it isn't the way of the flesh. Here the argument turns on the ambiguity of this key term. For Paul, flesh is not simply physicality. It always carries the connotation of corruptibility or actual rebellion, of the turning away of humankind in general, or Israel in particular, from God. Paul has been specially concerned to emphasize that circumcision is merely a matter of flesh, not that he has suddenly become a dualist, rejecting the physical world of space, time, and matter, but that for him the word flesh is a way of denoting that which will decay and die. Flesh is not something that will last. There it is again, as in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, when the perfect comes, then the partial will be abolished. So now he says, you need to escape from the flesh, not go courting it. If you emphasize flesh, see what company you will be keeping. You will be putting yourselves alongside those very pagans whose lifestyle you so despise. So you need to order your life in line with the Spirit. That is the way, the only way, to avoid the works of the flesh that you see all around you within paganism. You can't do it through circumcision, an outward or ethnic adherence to the Mosaic law. Now at last we can understand the significance of the throwaway line we have overheard from the next table. If you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the Mosaic law. This has nothing whatever to do with preferring spontaneity to rules. It has everything to do with the new covenant in which God is pouring out his Spirit upon those who are in Christ, so that in them, the life which the law wanted to produce, but could not, will at last be fulfilled. See Romans chapter 8 verses 1 through 11. And when that happens, this is the point of being not under the law. The Mosaic law has no role in producing this behavior, even though, as it were, it might now look on and applaud from the sidelines. In other words, you do not have to become a Jew by taking on the Mosaic law in order to be a flourishing and fruitful member of God's people. In fact, paradoxically, If you do go that route, you will find yourself stuck at the same level as the pagans from whom you want to distance yourself. Thus Paul launches into the list of those behaviors he associates with the flesh, many of which, as we noted before, could be practiced by a malevolent disembodied spirit, so there's no question of his disapproving of these styles of action because they have anything to do with physicality. Rather, he disapproves because they're what happens when humankind turns in on itself and away from God. Now the works of the flesh are obvious. They are such things as fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, hostilities, strife, jealousy, bursts of rage, selfish ambition, factiousness, divisions, moods of envy, drunkenness, wild partying and similar things. I told you before and I tell you again, people who do such things will not inherit God's kingdom. Chapter 5, verses 19 through 21. Notice the last line. The kingdom is coming, on earth as in heaven, and these are the roads which do not lead in that direction. They are the ways in which people on earth keep the life of heaven at bay, and so make a covenant with death, declaring by their behavior that they want to keep earth just the way it is, in its present corrupt and decaying form. As with virtue, so with vice. The point is not that these styles of behavior are prohibited by some arbitrary legalistic divinity, determined to stop humans being themselves or having a good time. These are things which exhibit the signs of dehumanization, of that corrupt version of humankind which, left to itself, is keeping God's promised future at bay. What's more, as Shakespeare saw only too well, they are customs of the heart, habits, which will solidify and prove next to impossible to shift. That's the point of the word vice. Once the habits settle down, they will have you in a grip which you won't be able to loosen. By contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, great-heartedness, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. There is no law that opposes things like that. Chapter 5, verses 22 through 23. The last line is heavily ironic. I think you'll find that none of those things is against the law. In other words, if this is what God's redeemed people look like, don't you think the law would be extremely pleased? It indicates the main thing Paul is saying. He is not saying, once the Spirit has taken up residence in a person or community, these are the things which will happen automatically, as though thereby to reinforce the romantic or existentialist approach to behavior against some kind of legalism. Nor is he saying, now that you've got the Spirit, isn't it great that you can get rid of that silly old law with all its moral restrictions? Rather, he is saying, this, after all, is the behavior which the Spirit produces. Can't you see that you don't need to impose the Mosaic law on converts in order to generate people like that? We should note carefully that Paul writes here of the fruit, singular, not the fruits, plural, of the Spirit. Just as Plato and others insisted that if you want truly to possess one of the cardinal virtues, you must possess them all, because each is, as it were, kept in place by the others, so Paul does not envisage that someone might cultivate one or two of these characteristics and reckon that she had enough of an orchard to be going on with. No, when the Spirit is at work, you will see all nine varieties of this fruit. Paul does not envisage specialization. And just to be clear what is not meant, he rounds off the discussion with a sentence which functions as a warning to his readers not to imagine that they can stay with the flesh and expect still to be part of the Christ people, the messianic community. Those who belong to the Messiah Jesus, he says, crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Chapter 5, verse 24. They crucified the flesh. This corresponds to what Paul said near the start of the theological argument of the letter. I have been crucified with the Messiah. Chapter 2, verse 19. And this sentence, though designed for another purpose, serves to alert us, with our own questions, to a key point which could otherwise be overlooked. The key is this. The fruit of the Spirit does not grow automatically. The nine varieties of fruit do not suddenly appear just because someone has believed in Jesus, has prayed for God's Spirit, and has then sat back and waited for fruit to arrive. Oh, there may well be strong and sudden initial signs that fruit is on the way. Many new Christians, particularly when a sudden conversion has meant a dramatic turning away from a lifestyle full of the works of the flesh, report their own astonishment at the desire that springs up within them to love, to forgive, to be gentle, to be pure. Where, they ask, has all this come from? I didn't used to be like this. That is a wonderful thing, a sure sign of the Spirit's working. But this doesn't mean it's all downhill from there. These are the blossoms. To get the fruit, you have to learn to be a gardener. You have to discover how to tend and prune, how to irrigate the field, how to keep birds and squirrels away. You have to watch for blight and mold, cut away ivy and other parasites that suck the life out of the tree, and make sure the young trunk can stand firm in strong winds. Only then will the fruit appear. And, in case anyone should think I'm imposing an alien note on Paul's cheerful list of these wonderful characteristics, surely, thinks the easygoing romantic Christian, all these things will just happen by themselves now that the Spirit is within me. We note the final characteristic in the list, self-control. If the fruit were automatic, why would self-control be needed? Answer, it isn't. So it is. It isn't automatic, so it is needed. All the varieties of fruit Paul mentions here are comparatively easy to counterfeit, especially in young, healthy, happy people, except for self-control. If that isn't there, it's always worth asking whether the appearance of the other sorts of fruit is just that, an appearance, rather than a real sign of the Spirit's work. That, we may guess, is why Paul immediately adds the note of crucifixion. Those who belong to the Messiah Jesus crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Verse 24. There are many parasites, many alien shrubs that will threaten to choke the fruit-bearing tree, many predators ready to nibble the roots or snatch the fruit before it ripens. There must be a conscious choice of mind, heart, and will to deal with all such enemies without mercy. Suddenly, we realize that we are in exactly the same place Colossians chapter 3 verse 5 took us. Put to death, therefore, all that is earthly. For earthly in Colossians, read flesh in Galatians. Paul's point is substantially the same in both places, as we see in the overlap between the things that need to be killed off in Colossians and the works of the flesh in Galatians. Only when this putting to death is done can Paul's closing command be obeyed. If we live by the Spirit, let's line up with the Spirit. Chapter 5, verse 25. The second clause could be translated, let's walk by the Spirit. But the root for walk can also refer to things lined up in a row, and in either case the point is clear. Just because you live in the Spirit, that doesn't make following the Spirit's direction automatic. You have to choose to do it. And you can. This is the very point on which, many centuries later, Paul could have been invoked to settle a long-running argument in discussions of morality. Some theologians have distinguished carefully between the sort of virtue you can acquire by unaided hard work and the sort you can have only if God gives it to you. The question is then raised, is there no work involved in the latter kind? Paul's answer is emphatic here and throughout his writings. Christian virtue, including the ninefold fruit of the Spirit, is both the gift of God and the result of the person of faith making conscious decisions to cultivate this way of life and these habits of heart and mind. In technical language, these things are both infused and acquired, though the way we acquire them is itself, in that same language, infused. We are here, as so often in theology, at the borders of language, because we are trying to talk at the same time about something God does and something humans do, as if God was simply another character like ourselves, as though, in other words, the interplay of God's work and our work could be imagined on the model of two people collaborating on a project. There are mysteries here that we do not need to explore further at this point. It is sufficient to note that the varieties of spiritual fruit Paul names, like the Christian virtues, remain both the work of the Spirit and the result of conscious choice and work on the part of the person concerned. We could make the same point by a different route, joining up with some of our earlier discussions. The basic command to human beings, and to the whole animal kingdom, as I wrote this sentence, two sparrows outside my window were delightfully obeying the Creator's command, was to be fruitful and multiply. Paul can draw on exactly that language to refer to the early growth in faith and life of the young Christian churches, e.g. Colossians chapter 1 verses 6 and 10. But the point about spiritual fruit is that, however healthy the tree, it has to be looked after. Leave it for too long untended and unpruned, and it will go wild. Once again, the conduct which Paul expects the Spirit to produce will not come by the Spirit's bypassing the mind, the will, the conscious choice of young Christians. They have to crucify the flesh. They have to be transformed by the renewal of their minds. Then, when they are led by the Spirit, they will not be under the law, but they will not be living in the romantic ideal of spontaneous, unreflective behavior either, any more than they will be blindly following a list of arbitrary rules. They will be discovering the true meaning of human freedom. Chapter 5, verse 1 and 13. The meaning for which humans were made in the first place. The meaning to which the Jewish law pointed, but which they can attain only through dying and rising with the Messiah. They will be truly free, walking on the high road that leads to that full authenticity, which is the goal of Christian living. And the road consists of the Spirit-led practice, like the practice of a language or a musical instrument, of the Christian virtues. 4. So where do the three virtues and the ninefold types of fruit join up? How do they work together, as Paul clearly thinks they do? The serious reader of Paul naturally approaches this question from one angle, trying to see Paul's ethical thought as a clear and coherent structure. But of course, Paul himself approaches it from a variety of different angles, depending on which question he is addressing to which church. We can, however, begin to draw some threads together before moving on to the third main theme of this chapter, the appeal for unity, and the habits of heart, mind, and practice which contribute toward it. First, does it not look as though, despite our insistence that virtue is the deep center of what Paul is exploring, that he is bringing in rules again, but by the back door? When he describes in detail how agape behaves, not jealous or boastful, not arrogant or rude, and so on, and when he insists that the whole law is summed up in this commandment, is he not saying, well, you must cultivate these habits, but this is because that's the best way to keep the rules? The answer to this question is no, but explaining that leads us to an interesting point. There is an old saying, give someone a fish and you feed them for a day. Teach someone to fish and you feed them for life. Paul's normal practice in teaching his converts is the latter. His version of the saying seems to be, give people a command for a particular situation and you help them to live appropriately for a day. Teach them to think Christianly about behavior, and they will be able to navigate by themselves into areas where you hadn't given any specific instructions. But what Paul does again and again is to give initial guidelines, especially in areas where the outworking of Christian virtue will lead people into behavior patterns that will look surprising to them, and perhaps shocking to their neighbors. They will need to be reassured that this is indeed the way to go. Instructions that could look like simple old rules are, for the most part, guidelines to keep them on track while they are learning the habits of the heart. Just as he is certainly not lapsing back into a legalism which would undermine his teaching on grace and faith, that was always a strange suggestion, which could only have grown out of a misreading of him in the first place, so he is not lapsing back toward a rules-based ethic while purporting to advocate a virtue-based one. Another illustration may help, and may show that this is not a matter of playing rules and virtue off against each other, but of seeing the former within the larger framework of the latter. When the local authorities build roads for cars to travel long distances, highways, motorways, call them what you will, they naturally intend that people should drive along these roads in full control of their cars. Ideally, nobody will ever stray from their side of the road into the path of traffic coming in the other direction. But because from time to time people have been known to lose concentration, to fall asleep at the wheel, to be distracted by a pet dog in the back seat or whatever, and because sometimes a puncture or other mechanical failure may cause a car to behave erratically, no matter what the driver is doing, the wise highway builders construct a central barrier so that any car drifting toward the oncoming traffic will be stopped in its tracks. Better to bounce back among cars going in the same direction than lurch into a head-on collision. Likewise, they build a rumble strip at the outer edge of the highway, short of any fence or ditch, which makes a loud noise if your wheels touch it, to keep drivers from running off the road. Those responsible for building roads are not saying, there you are, there's a nice crash barrier. Bounce off that and you'll be all right. They're saying, you are supposed to drive down the road without touching the barriers, but if something goes wrong, you may need to know that the barrier is there. Applying this to Paul's ethics, we may want to add that, amid the multiple moral muddles of ancient paganism, and with his wide and diverse pastoral experience, Paul is no doubt well aware that however much he may want the virtues and the fruit to be chosen, developed, and put into practice by every single Christian and by the church as a whole, there are going to be many cases where one cannot simply wait for that to happen. One cannot, in the meantime, leave people with no guidance.